As I said at the beginning of the show, it must have been hell for a postman at the time of Alexander the Great, because there were Alexandrias thither and yon. A dozen, apparently. We'll come to that later. But the lost city of Alexandria in Afghanistan was one of the meeting points of East and West for centuries. Then it disappeared for a couple of thousand years. Found again initially with the discovery of coins and other artefacts in 1833 by a mysterious chap, Charles Masson. Cockney accent, claimed to be an American from Kentucky, and classicists have been fascinated by him for years because his discoveries were so important. But only one scholar, Edmund Richardson, has managed to flesh out his true story. Edmund has spent over 10 years retracing Masson's footsteps in India, Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's written a new book called Alexandria, The Quest for the Lost City, which our old friend William Dalrymple has described as an utterly brilliant biography. Edmund is Associate Prof of Classics at Durham, and we're delighted to have him on the program. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be on the program. Thank you.
Now, Charles Masson, self-taught archaeologist and explorer, set the scene for us. What was going on in the region when he was there in the 19th century?
So this is the rise of the British East India Company, which William Dalrymple has told the story of wonderfully. It's this private corporation which basically spreads out its tentacles across much of India, creeps in from the coasts, and becomes, by the mid-19th century, one of the dominant powers in Asia. It's got its own private army, it's bullied, it's blackmailed, it's deposed its way across much of India. And it is basically a machine for extracting profit from India and transferring it over to Britain. And it's run on the ground by, you know, a bunch of British administrators and a very ragtag army, and a private soldier in that army is our friend Charles Masson.
The great game, jockeying for influence, and as you point out, rogue characters aplenty. Before we hear Masson's story, I want us to enter a cave some years later. This is at Bamiyan in Afghanistan in 1924. Two excited archaeologists descended into an unknown cave, and hidden behind was an astounding 170-foot-tall statue of the Buddha. I'll let you take up the story.
So the great Buddhas of Bamiyan, destroyed notoriously by the Taliban, were one of the great wonders of the ancient world. As you say, these enormous statues carved out of a cliff face in Afghanistan, just looming out over the valleys. And they fascinated travelers for years. It was only really in the mid-19th century that people actually realized they were statues of Buddha. But these two French archaeologists, early in the 20th century, are convinced that they are about to find incredible things. They're scrambling down this cliff face into this cave, which they don't, they're, it's like the most inaccessible spot you could imagine. And they're thinking, okay, this is their kind of hero moment, right? This is the thing that's going to make them be remembered forever. So they sort of arrive in the cliff face in a kind of a tumble and a cloud of dust and pick themselves up off the floor, and are thinking like, okay, right, we've made it, like, guys, we have done it. Like, no one can have set foot in this cave for thousands of years.
Like, this is like the opening of Toot's tomb, isn't it?
Right, it's one of those like marvelous moments where you feel the past is about to reveal itself. But the first thing that these two archaeologists find is not, you know, the crown of an unknown king or, you know, rich treasures of gold. They see two little rude lines of verse scratched in the wall of the cave right in front of their noses. And the closer they look, the more their hearts sink, because the little line of verse says, if any fool this high Samuch, Samuch is a cave, if any fool this high Samuch explore, no Charles Masson has been here before. They pick themselves up the floor of the cave, and they slowly climb back out of the cliff, feeling very sorry for themselves.
One of your rave reviews, I think it's in the Sunday Times, says Masson is the quixotic and wildly colourful subject of this exceptional biography. One of the great early travellers. He was also a pioneering archaeologist, a ferocious critic of British imperialism, and a Russian spy. A critic of British imperialism?
He is not the normal voice that we get from the 19th century writing about empire from the British perspective. The stories that tend to get handed down to us tend to be from people who did very well out of empire, people who were rich, aristocratic, often, you know, looted huge amounts of the world and brought the treasures home to Britain. Masson is something different. He's an ordinary working class boy from London. He is been on the wrong end of British imperial power more than a few times. And he sees straight through the sort of gloss and the stories of colonialism to the darkness at the heart of it. He sees exactly why the British build their empire, and he realizes just what the consequences of that empire are. So he becomes an absolutely ferocious critic of British imperialism, and of course,
Edmund, why did he change his name? Because he was really James Lewis.
His real name was indeed James Lewis, and that name carries him a relatively far distance through life till his late 20s. But then in 1827, he's a private soldier in the British East India Company's army. And on July 4th, 1827, he deserts. So he runs away from his regiment in Agra, and he sets out on foot alone across India and Afghanistan. Begins this remarkable journey that carries on for years, just one guy alone, no friends, no money, no help, no anything. But of course, as soon as he's run away from the British East India Company, well, they don't like that very much. And ordinary soldiers who deserted tended to have very bad things happen to them. They tended to be brought back in chains, executed sometimes in very unpleasant ways. So Masson, he changes his name from James Lewis to Charles Masson. And from the moment he leaves his regiment in India behind, he's on the run. He's fleeing.
You tell us that he faked his own death.
He may well have done more than a few times. We know several people thought he was dead at several points in his life. He so frequently kind of disappears into stories and into legends where there's no way of, you know, knowing what's true and what's false, that it's very hard to know just how many times he faked his own death. We do know he read his own obituary and wrote a rather sarcastic letter in response to it on at least one occasion.
Talking to Edmund Richardson about this extraordinary fellow, I didn't realise that many European soldiers would desert in order to enjoy more lucrative posts in the rival armies of the Afghans, the Sikhs and the Marathas.
Yeah, so basically private soldier was, if you weren't an officer, if you're an ordinary soldier, that was often quite literally a dead-end job. They would march you up and down India and basically work you until you couldn't do anything else, until you were either dead or you were just completely broken. So quite a few British soldiers try to slip away and look for better lives. So you see all these little cords of like local chiefs, local warlords, and sometimes the great empires like the Sikh Empire of Ranjit Singh. There's often quite a few European or British soldiers or mercenaries hanging around these courts trying to make their fortune, trying to maybe command some of the local troops, maybe trying to make gunpowder. Some of them manage that better than others. Some of them get blown up in unfortunate ways. But basically trying to make themselves useful and trying to make their fortunes in ways which European countries and European societies at the time just wouldn't let them.
So much to tell, so little time. I want you to tell me about an American mercenary, a traveller, mountebank, and 10-cent Machiavelli called Josiah Harlan.
Josiah Harlan is quite a man. He sets out from America when he's very young, aiming to make himself a fortune, and if possible, also make himself a king. He ends up, after a series of rather unfortunate misadventures, leading a ragtag bunch of mercenaries into Afghanistan, trying to depose the ruler of Afghanistan and set up the exiled king, Shah Shuja, on the throne. Harlan carries with him, you know, a gigantic American flag, a beloved dog, and a bunch of adventurers and soldiers of fortune, one of whom for a while is our friend Charles Masson. Harlan makes a lot of plans, though none of them really quite work out the way he hopes.
I think it's wonderful that he was one of Kipling's models for the man who would be king. Boy, you've got a cast of characters here, haven't you? Now, I've got to skip a fair bit because I want to get on to the plethora of Alexandrias. Why were there so many?
Alexander the Great is probably one of the best performers of his own story. He realized from a very early age he wanted to be remembered forever. He wanted to be up there with the heroes of legend like Achilles. He wanted to be up there even with the gods. So as his army makes its way from Greece into what was for the Greeks the unknown world, across Persia into Egypt, through the plains of Central Asia and Afghanistan, down into India, Alexander leaves a whole string of cities in his wake. He calls them all after himself, Alexandria. There's at least a dozen. Some ancient authors think there's maybe up to 70 of them.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Edmund, but thank God Trump didn't know about this. Otherwise, we wouldn't just have had Trump Towers. We would have had Trump cities scattering the Northern Hemisphere.
I genuinely shudder to think. I think there is an Israeli settlement called Trump Heights in the Golan Heights, which I'm just one of those places I just struggle to believe exist, but unfortunately do.
But you also make the point that you see a sort of relationship between Masson and Alexander.
There's a lovely word in ancient Greek called pathos, and it means a sort of longing so great it bursts your heart open, a desire for the impossible. And it's that kind of irrational desire for something that's just completely outrageous, but also wonderful and inspiring, which kind of connects Masson and Alexander. Alexander, of course, is notoriously the person who goes further, sees stranger things, and has wilder adventures than pretty much anyone in recorded history before him. And Masson, this guy who, without obviously wealth or army or status or anything like that, on his own, spends years wandering the hills of Afghanistan on his own, searching for Alexander's lost cities.
I like this quote of yours. Almost everyone he met seemed to have a story, a rumour of ancient ruins over the horizon, a battered silver coin worn around a child's neck, a man who claimed Alexander as his ancestor.
And people still do in northern India and parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan claim that they're descended from Alexander the Great. I actually, in part of research for this book, I went to a little village in the foothills of the Himalayas where everyone claims that they're descended from Alexander the Great. The family business is no longer world conquest, but actually cultivating what's allegedly the most potent marijuana on earth. I had to kind of really say, no, look, I'm here for the stories of Alexander. No, really, I'm not here for the drugs. Honestly, no, really, actually, thank you. Stories about Alexander. But these stories are still being told, which is rather wonderful, I think.
Does anything of Manson that Manson found, is it, say, in the Brit Museum or other splendid places?
Yeah, Manson was like robbed of pretty much everything he owned more than a few times. So it's kind of miraculous that so many of his finds survive, but they do. There's a few rather wonderful pieces in the British Museum. There's this golden casket, for instance. It's called the Bimaran casket, and it's the earliest datable depiction of the Buddha which has ever been found. It's rather wonderful because here's the earliest image of the Buddha that we have. And he's dressed like a Greek, and he's flanked by two Hindu gods. And it's this wonderful sort of sense of a multicultural world that was beyond the imagination of most scholars in Masson's time.
There's so much more that you've written about and discovered about Masson that we haven't got time for, but let me ask you this. How did he finish up?
Not well. He made some remarkable discoveries in Afghanistan, tens of thousands of coins and artifacts. He located Alexander's lost city on the plains of Bagram, but his excavations came to a halt when the British East India Company decided they wanted to get their hands on Afghanistan. The British invaded. Masson couldn't bear to be an accomplice to this invasion, so he left Afghanistan. He ends up back in London, desperately trying to get his hands on his finds, ignored by British society because he was such a strong critic of British imperialism and the invasion of Afghanistan.
We're out of time, Edmund, and it's been a delight to talk to you. Edmund Richardson, Associate Professor of Classics at Durham, the author of Alexandria, The Quest for the Lost City, published by Bloomsbury.